One of my colleagues in Seattle, Washington, belongs to an interfaith clergy group, and he told me this story of one time. They have a tradition there that the most senior member of that group gets to tell their life story, what they call Odyssey. And so one day it was the Roman Catholic priest's turn to tell his life story, and he began by saying something really startling. He said that he felt his life was mostly a failure. He remembered those heady days of Vatican II and how hopeful he and his generation of priests had been. They were hopeful that real change was coming to the church that they loved. And yet, after these many, many years, he felt that the church, if anything, had become hardened and more conservative in his eyes. And so he realized that his dreams had not come to be. Now, this priest was someone who was highly regarded, very respected in his community of colleagues, and his colleagues were hurt and startled by this revelation. And yet one of the colleagues noticed that despite the severity of his words, his demeanor seemed very calm and accepting and peaceful. And so he asked him, "How can you claim that your life was a failure and yet you seem so calm and serene?" And the priest answered, "It's because I know whose I am. I know whose I am." Now notice, he didn't say, "I know who I am." He said, "I know whose I am." Now, both of these things are important, of course. It's important to know who you are as a distinct individual personality. And it is also important to know whose you are, to extend that sense of self into all the relationships that we have ever been a part of and ever will be a part of. So just as we affirm our first principle of the inherent worth and dignity of the person, we also affirm the seventh principle, which is the interconnected web that we are all a part of that binds us each to all. Inasmuch as we admire the strength of the self-reliant individual, we know that we don't have any identity outside the relationships. I am because you are. Ubuntu. I am because you are. You can't be a person by yourself. And so to ask, whose am I, is to extend the question far beyond the self-inflated ego. It is to ask questions like, who needs me? Who loves me? Who's counting on me? To whom am I accountable? Whose blood runs through my veins? What tradition am I accountable to? What kind of life depends on me? What kind of life is altered by my choices? To whom do I belong? What calls me to walk the path of integrity and compassion and truth? Who or what holds me in my coming out and going in? Who holds me in the hollow of its hand? Whose are you? Whose are you? Asking this question forces us to shift our minds and hearts from me to we. From me to we. The Reverend Burton Carley once said that we is not just a mutually satisfying relationship. It asks of each party to care for the spiritual health and growth of another, even to the point of inconvenience, discomfort, and sacrifice. This is exactly what Kurt was talking about. Another name for this is love. Love is the work of this congregation. Love is our vocation, our call, I would call it a vocation because it is both a calling from our tradition, from our faith, and it is work. Sometimes it feels like really hard work. Standing on the side of love, raising our voices for justice, being a force for good in the world, these are things we do. These are things we will continue to do. And yet sometimes, in the busyness of our doing things out there in the world, we sometimes forget to be a force for good right here within our own walls. Sometimes we forget that loving means to stretch ourselves beyond comfort, beyond convenience, beyond satisfaction. You know, sometimes when we become friends with people around here, we kind of get used to the idea that maybe this place is a social hall, a social gathering, but it's not. This community, this congregation, is a community of practice, a community of intentional practice. If we are to be a model of beloved community, then our congregation must represent a whole and glorious diversity. And so we must be inclusive, fully inclusive of all kinds of religious views, generational, ethnic, racial diversity. And then there's political diversity. It's a little harder for some of us. Mental and physical disability, class, gender diversity, and many others. Those are things that will cause us to stretch and be uncomfortable, beyond comfort, beyond satisfaction, but it's something that will move us from me to we. Now, when the congregation is as diverse as we are, what in the world can hold us together? What holds us together? Certainly, it's not a creed, right? It's not a doctrine. It's not a pope or a bishop. What holds us together is a promise. At the heart of our faith is actually not a promise, but it is the act of making a promise. It's the willingness to enter into a covenant with each other. And although the specifics of covenant vary with each congregation, the overall spirit of Unitarian Universalist covenant is expressed here. In your order of service, someone have one they can hold up? Yes, that one. It's written by Alice Blair Wesley, and it says, "We pledge to walk together in truth and affection as best we know them now or may learn them in the days to come, that we and our children may be fulfilled, that we may speak to the world in words and actions of peace and goodwill." Covenant is a statement of the nature of reality. It's an agreement to sustain the relationships that brought us together in the first place. Because human beings are inherently relational, our lives are defined by the promises we make and keep. We are promise-making, promise-breaking, and promise-renewing creatures, aren't we? The philosopher Hannah Arendt described promises as the uniquely human way of ordering the future, making it predictable and reliable to the extent that it is humanly possible. Promises are at the heart of covenant groups. Forming covenant groups is one way that our congregation makes love tangible, makes it real. It's our way of creating a community of justice and peace right here within our walls so that we can imagine it here first and then take it out to the larger world. So how many of you have been in covenant groups? All right. For the rest of you who have no idea what a covenant group is, let me paint you a little picture. First, you sign up on the blue form. Sign up for a covenant group for a time that fits your schedule. And then the facilitator calls you and says, here's the date we're going to start. Here's the location and the time. It'll probably be sometime in October. The day comes, and you arrive not really knowing what to expect and not knowing a whole lot of people. The chairs, you noticed, are arranged in a circle, and there's a small table in the middle that holds the chalice. And the circle always includes an empty chair. And that chair is a symbol of welcome and the group's willingness to grow and always include one more, even when it is uncomfortable, even when it's inconvenient and a personal sacrifice. You come in, but you're not really sure why you're there. You're not quite sure what drew you there, but you know that you're looking for something. You're trying to find a place to belong and a welcoming space where you can make sense of the things that are going on in your life. You spend that first meeting writing a covenant that will sustain and enrich your relationships. And then each person does a check-in where no one responds, no one judges, and no one gives advice. It's just an open time for you to talk about what's happening in your life. And you realize that you don't remember ever having this kind of attentive audience, a time where people were really listening instead of trying to formulate a response in their own heads. Then there's a reading, and then there's a central theme or a topic that you all contribute to. After 2 hours, a time that goes by very quickly, the group ends with a closing circle. You go back every 2 weeks or so, and each time you go back, a little more space opens up where you're able to speak the truth about who you are and whose you are. The most powerful practice in covenant groups is this deep listening. The poet Naomi Shihab Nye describes our longing for this kind of listening. She writes, "Some ears are tunnels. Some ears are tunnels. Your words go in and get lost in the dark. Some ears are flat pans, like the miners use looking for gold. What you say will be washed out with the stones. You look for a long time till you find the right ears." People in our covenant groups practice having the right ears. Now, on the surface, people here in this community may seem very similar, but we really all have very, very different experiences of life. I think the natural human impulse is to rush to sameness. And in our minds, while the other is speaking, we want to say, "Yes, yes, I know exactly what you mean." Or, "Yeah, the same thing happened to me. I know exactly what you're going through." And this is the difference between a social conversation and a spiritual practice of covenant groups. The spiritual practice allows for a person to have his or her own unique experience without others laying their stuff on top of it. It's a way of paying respect and really honoring that person. The practice is to hold open a space of compassion and non-judgment, and this can be done by not saying a word. It can be done simply by opening your heart and breathe and being present. In addition to cultivating the ears, the right ears, the other essential practice of covenant groups is to shift from me to we. Because it's not always about me and what I need and what works for me and doesn't work for me. So I will share with you a confession. I don't really like small group sharing. I don't always like being invited to sit in a circle and share my feelings with other people. It doesn't always work for me to share my deepest feelings and reveal myself to others. Sometimes I get a little grumpy when others are facilitating this kind of thing. And yet I make you do it all the time. But you know, even though I don't feel like doing it all the time, I do it anyway. I do it anyway because I want to shift from me to we. I do it because I stop thinking about me and what I need and start thinking about you and what you might need and think that maybe, possibly, what I share might help you and might help the group. And so, even though I don't always feel like it, I do it anyway. And I have never, ever regretted it. The only thing I ever regret is holding back. The only thing I ever regret is keeping silent. I know that I do that out of self-protection. I do that because I feel like there's danger somehow. But of course, there is no real danger. These are groups of warm-hearted, non-judgmental, open and caring people. And once you join a covenant group, you will quickly come to see that it's worth it. It's worth it to shift from me to we, shifting from what I want to how can I serve others? How can I be of benefit to others? And that has made all the difference. We need one another. We need one another in times of trouble and despair, temptation and defeat. We need one another in times of triumph and accomplishment. May we all strive day by day to live up to our promise to walk together in truth and affection so that we may know whose we are. Amen.